This is the Kinky Cast. This is an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 88 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. Today we hear from Bendy of the New England Fetish Flea Market. Here's your host, the Beast.
Thank you, Max. And we're here tonight for a very interesting podcast with a colorful person that I have great admiration for.
Thank you.
Hi, Bendy.
Hi, how are you doing, Mr. Beast?
I am great. I'm great. And let me just scan Bendy's. She's a writer, activist, performer, producer, and all-around flexi gal. Her full name is Bendy Yoga Girl. And where did that name come from?
Well, it was originally a name I used on a dating site. Gosh, must have been about 15 or more years ago.
You aren't old enough to have been on a dating site 15 years ago.
I am in my mid to late 40s.
So. I wasn't gonna do that to you.
I remember when OkCupid was founded in San Francisco, or was it Match.com? Anyway, it was a long time ago. I was living in Boston, and my working circumstances created the necessity for me to have a surname in the community just to protect myself from losing my job. And so I just went back to Bendy Yoga Girl. And I figured people would call me Bendy for short, which they do. And being a yoga teacher, it was a way for people to refer to me without it being awkward or outing me. And then it stuck, and now it's fun.
And now you're trying to make a brand out of it.
I kind of am a brand. And I have a lot of information that I'd like to share. So it'll go together nicely, I think.
And how did you get started in all of this? You have dated yourself a bit. So that means that you were entering right at the beginning of the internet era.
No, even before.
Before the internet. So tell us about before the internet. What was the world like?
It was very different. You could make a phone call at a payphone for 25 cents or maybe even 10. I've actually been this way my whole life. So as long as I've been aware of any kind of sexuality or relationship to men, because I'm typically heterosexual, I've had the feelings and preferences that I have. So for me, it's been my whole life.
What was it like, though, before the internet? How did you get into this lifestyle? Post-internet, people go to FetLife.com, make a network, and all of a sudden, party invitations start flowing in. And it wasn't always like that.
No, and when I was really young, I don't think that would have been appropriate. So, you know, I got into it by sharing with people I was dating what my preferences are and how I like to relate. And it was a lot of, I don't want to say trial and error, I would say successes and mistakes for me to learn about the difference between dominance and domineering and how to be healthy in my submission and healthy in my masochism. And I'm not sure that the internet would have made any difference, honestly, because that was the exploration I needed to do. I was never on alt.com or any of the chat rooms. I don't typically use the internet to build relationships. It's more of a information center or simple, you know, email communications. I prefer to do my building as in person as possible.
Which in the early days, that was the necessity. And it forced us, I think, to work on negotiation skills and the communication skills that I think sometimes we're skipping. Some of the newer people may be getting shortchanged on those skill building exercises.
You know, I don't know. It probably depends on who the person is. But, I mean, certainly the velocity has picked up and the how available information and connections are. And now that the web is so integrated into, I don't know about you, but it's fully integrated into my life, you know, it's a tool and it can help or harm depending on how it's used.
Well, and I speak about the internet as I'm juggling a cell phone, smartphone in one hand, and a tablet in the other. And you just moments ago sent me email with your bio on it. So, yes, I think we're fairly integrated, and the podcast is delivered out via the internet.
Yeah, and if not for the internet, we wouldn't have the fantastic resource that you've created.
Thank you, thank you.
You know, I mean, it was all, you had to know somebody. Even in San Francisco back in the, gosh, when did I get there, 93 or so, very, very different. And San Francisco's a hub, you know, for all of this.
Well, it was a hub from the beginning, really.
Yeah.
From the 60s even, it was beginning to develop, and definitely it was really, the seed had taken and was germinating in the 70s, and we've talked to several of those San Francisco pioneers on the podcast, and the stories they have to tell about what the evolution out there. So you were there a bit later.
I was there a bit later. I was there in the first wave of .com. So very early on at Yahoo and moving forward.
What was it like going to your first play party?
I'm thinking.
There's been a lot, well, there's a whole, since.
Yeah, I mean, they're different kinds. One of the early ones that really sticks out for me was an orgy hosted by Carol Queen.
Oh, wow.
And that was so magical and mystical and, for me, relief in a way. That the space she created was ridiculously inclusive and pansexual and sacred. For me, it felt like a homecoming. You know, but this was pretty late in the 1990s, and I had already had decades of private exploration before then. So I just was so happy, you know.
To find a room full of fellow searchers.
Yeah, and I think the context of it being an expression of sacred sexuality was, for me, I was very resonant with that as an idea and as a practice. Still am.
You got your intro to the public side in the late 90s.
I had been doing it for 15 years.
But you've been doing it behind doors for quite a few years before that.
Mm-hmm.
And now you are an activist and producer.
That's what they tell me.
And your activism, though, started back, I'm willing to bet, in San Francisco, did
it? It actually started even younger than that. My parents are feminists, and my mother used to take me to NOW meetings when I was in middle school. And so I just had a really, I guess, specific kind of introduction to the idea of not just having a belief, but taking action on it, as well as co-creating a world that's compassionate and inclusive. My parents were so good at introducing me to as many different colors and sizes and ages and orientations and expressions of people as possible. I know they were very intentional with that. And I grew up in the arts, so even an idea of just somebody being homosexual was fully integrated and ingrained into my life experience from a really young age. So when the AIDS crisis came on and I started watching people die, and I was young, you know, I was a teenager, very different experience than my peers who were reading the Time articles. And then for me to see it and to experience it and to just, you know, watch people be excommunicated from their families and churches for who they are, I'm not sure that it could have been any other way. So as soon as I could vote, clearly, you know, I started taking action that way. And as I got older, I have this thing about walking my talk as much as I can.
You were at the things I've read somewhere that you worked with the National Organization of Women, and you're a feminist.
Yeah, I used to attend those meetings and participated a bit in my hometown. And then when I got to San Francisco, did some stuff with San Francisco Sex Information and pretty high-level volunteering with the Burning Man organization. I was working with their board of directors, not on the board, working with the board.
So you've been to a burn or two.
Oh yeah. I stopped going in 99.
You stopped going in 99.
I stopped going in 99.
For our listeners that aren't quite plugged in, give them a brief description of the Burning Man experience.
For me, it was. I can't speak to how it is today. It was a act of radical inclusion and expression and creative process, co-creative process, as well as, you know, politics and working with and rather than against organizations that can take you out of a space, including fire marshals and city permits and, you know, waste management.
And this is because Burning Man is actually a city that's created for a few weeks every year.
Yeah.
In the middle of the Nevada desert.
And there's no vegetation at all. And everybody participates. So a couple of the key concepts that have stuck with me is radical inclusion. So Larry Harvey's vision of taking the spectator out of the artistic process. And by stepping in to that context, everybody participates. As well as the idea of leave no trace. The intent from an organization perspective, and I'm sure this is still true, is that once the event ends, you know, there's a whole epilogue of people going back and cleaning up after everybody. The burn itself, that event, is the middle part of a story. It's the middle part of an arc. So before that is all the planning and all of the preparation and training and civic engineering, as well as getting the permits and making sure the budgets are on and, you know, preparation, and then the event. And then after, again, staying in integrity, walking the talk, and cleaning up the mess. Unfortunately, not everybody leaves no trace. So oftentimes, even back in the 90s, we were out there for weeks cleaning. I mean, I didn't live out there for weeks, but 4 weeks the cleaning went on.
And I encourage our listeners, if they aren't familiar with the Burning Man concept and the regional burns, that they Google Burning Man, and it will be a transformative experience if they should decide to participate in even one of the regional events.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know anybody who has come out of that without having been transformed in some way.
And yeah. That's very, very like when you become deeply involved in them. And the lifestyle, isn't it?
Depending upon how one participates, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about transformation through the lifestyle.
Yes, well, you are, we try to be inclusive. We try. We're still working on it, aren't we?
You don't see the smile on my face. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of rhetoric about that, for sure.
You describe yourself as a feminist. How do you reconcile feminism with
Masochism. Yeah.
How do you reconcile that? Because I know many of our listeners are going through the same turmoil on how that they can be a woman in control of her life and be subservient or enjoy having pain inflicted upon them.
That's a thesis level question. I would say the simple answer is change your story. It doesn't have to be in conflict. In fact, power and authority and choice, the freedom of choice, creates a great deal of privilege. And I'm privileged to be able to choose how I relate and how I experience the world and how I be in the world through my body. It was never really a problem. Like, intellectually, sure. But as far as my overall world experience, if this is my identity, and here we go back to how I was raised, if this is how I am, if this is how I be and how I feel, then the question is, how do I do it in a way that's healthy and supportive, more so than how do I make it be right? Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And I've heard women just cut to the very core of feminism. Feminism is your right to be who you are and choose your own path. And to deny yourself a path because it's not somebody else's politically correct is not feminism.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the world of Betty Friedan and Camille Paglia and, you know, the angry,
all the angry
resistance.
Yeah.
And, you know, thank goodness my mother did all the work that she did so I can be in this place of freedom. And then my master's degree is actually in philosophy or critical theory. So it's just, you know, it is. I don't even know if feminist is a correct descriptor for me anymore. You'd probably have to ask people who know me if they would consider me a feminist.
And you have moved through the lifestyle, and yeah. You've worked in several things. And one of them was creating spaces for activities. And you've also, though, worked with the New England Leather Alliance, which puts on this huge event.
Yep.
And what is this event?
Well, I don't know what the current statistics are on numbers. We were at about 4,000 for the weekend when I was really heavily involved. And its intent is to be an introduction to the lifestyle. And the way it manifests is through vending. So I think there are about 100 vendors that go that sell everything from shoes to floggers to, you know, bondage rigs to you name the fetish, you name the excitement. We, you know, try to have it there. And then a great deal of classes. I think we had 6 tracks the last year I co-produced. And the education piece, again, spans as much as possible. So bondage to transgender identity, BDSM in general, to master-slave dynamics, littles, puppies, human puppies, to, you know, whatever people suggest. And for a lot of folks, my understanding is it's a gateway event.
And I can imagine the post-50 Shades world.
Well, I got out like right about, that was my last year, I think. May not have been the best written piece of work in erotic history. Definitely opened up a dialogue. And I think a lot of people probably went from thinking I'm the only person to, oh, I'm not the only person.
And I think that many people give them freedom to explore these fantasies that they had mm-hmm. deeply buried for years as shameful, wrong, or just dangerous, and give them wings to give them a try, at least.
Yeah.
And the discussion can only be a positive one.
Ideally, yes.
There's always going to be some storm along the way, but we're making headways on the gay community. It's making some headways, finally, with some legal recognition.
Oh, yes.
Finally.
Well, I'm in Pennsylvania, where we're going to be voting on that soon. It's still not a right in Pennsylvania.
The sexual orientation
discrimination is still, yeah.
Well, here in Tennessee, we're going to be buried for a long time before that passes. We was among the states that 70-some% voted for the Marriage Act.
Uh-huh.
And then you're following the Kentucky issue right now, I'm sure.
The woman who wouldn't give out the marriage licenses.
Yeah. Claiming it was violated her religious freedom. So, yeah, the South is going to be a few years of catching up.
Well, I think the South has a lot of catching up to do in other areas as well. And, you know, race, of course, and the history, and how do you, well, I shouldn't say you personally, but how do we as a country get it and fix it? And I don't know that there's a simple answer for that.
Well, I don't think there is a simple answer. We are such a far-reaching and varied country now.
Yep.
From the ultra-conservative western states to California, whatever California is, to the northeastern states, and then we got the South, and they all are very entrenched in their beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And we all got to pull that together somehow as a country. It'll take some time, but I hope we will make it.
I hope so too. Right now, my view of America is we're a toddler with a book of matches. We've got all this fire, but, you know, are we really mature enough to handle?
Well, we can have a...
That's a whole other conversation.
And I would think that we both would fall on a straddle that line. And it's kind of scary. You are a teacher.
I am.
You call yourself a shaman. What was the term you used?
An adjective I use is shamanic, though I'm not sure that saying I'm a shamanic BDSM educator is accurate, especially with people like Raven Caldera and Lee Harrington walking the world.
They are amazing individuals, aren't they?
Yeah. And I mean, they are shaman.
And we've had both of them on the podcast, and they were great interviews.
And I don't know if you know about Coral Mallow.
No.
She's an ordeal. I don't know that she would identify as a minister, but to me, she's an ordeal, like a high priestess of ordeal. And, you know, she teaches on it. I am shamanic in some of my effects, but I'm not always shamanic in my intent.
Help our listeners understand what you just said.
You know, part of the path of a shaman, traditionally meaning in indigenous cultures thousands and thousands of generations ago, the shaman in the village is the person who holds the key to that space between the material and immaterial world and consciousness and experience. And depending upon where and when it occurs, they might be healers, they might officiate different ceremonies. Oftentimes, there are entheogens or psychotropic substances involved. So if you think of the person who leads the sweat lodge and gives the peyote as people sit around a fire and have a collective experience of prayer.
In the BDSM world, we also often work with very strong drugs and through our ordeals and our pain processes.
Yes. I don't personally use drugs in a BDSM context.
Well, I'm talking about the natural drugs that the body produces.
Yeah.
are quite powerful and can alter the mind at that moment.
I agree. Altered states.
So how does your education, your teaching, how's it in the shamanic direction?
Well, that's what I'm saying. My effect is, but not always my intent. So I don't typically, generally, I can't say always, but I don't generally set up a class or to be a ceremony or a ritual. And because I have so much direct experience with several different lineages and forms of shamanism, with actual shaman, not people who take ayahuasca four times and proclaim that they're a shaman, but they've been coming to me my whole life. And that it's impossible for that not to be a part of what I do, because it's such a big part of my own practice. So sometimes people will have a transformative experience in my class.
But that's never the goal you set out to accomplish.
I leave it open, but I don't personally hold myself responsible for other people's experiences in that context. I'm there to share. I'm there to offer. I'm there to listen. And what an individual takes from that is theirs.
I'm looking at your longer bio, and it talks about humor and informative,
yes,
and interactive. So what classes do you teach?
Well, you know, I'm just coming off a sabbatical, and I would say the main grouping would be spirituality and BDSM communication. I do a lot with communication and not the what to, rather how to communicate. Certainly, yoga and mindfulness is intertwined pretty much everywhere because it's a part of my vocation and the work that I do in the world. So I teach a lot about bottoming, and that can be anything from impact play to bondage to DS relationship dynamic. But my point of view, typically, mostly because that's where I sit, you know, is from the bottom. And I actually started teaching in kinky contexts as a response to going to classes, and particularly in skills-based classes, there was such a bias I was seeing towards the top, towards this is how you tie, this is what you do, this is how you do, this is what you do, this is when you do.
They are definitely slanted towards a doer.
Yeah. And the bottoms consistently were naked and silent. And that ruffled my feathers because erasing that part of the equation, silencing, and then also creating the power dynamic of nudity and objectification. For me, I wasn't learning anything about where I would fit in. And rather than get angry, I took action. So I figured, well, if that's the bias, then let's start to bring some voice into this side of the experience. And I know I'm not the only person who has done that, clearly.
I've just been hearing the last 5 or so years a greater emphasis on the bottom as individual, needing to actually know the same skills that the top knows in order to make safe and informed judgments about future play partners.
You know, that's actually really, if old guard leather exists, that's an old guard perspective, right? In order to become the master, you must first be a slave and go through the ranks.
I don't know if I see it from that perspective, but I do see that the bottom needs to know that about the skill that they enjoy receiving so that they can evaluate other play partners and even bring new ideals to their own play partners.
I would say, yes, that's important. And I don't know how to tie a tacatacote or a chest harness or a hip harness. I don't know how to throw a bullwhip, but what I know is how to receive and communicate what I'm experiencing. So personally, I want that to be magic. I want that to be auto magic. But what's important is that I get it from this is my opinion about me. I don't want to prescribe this to other people. But where it becomes important to me is, how is it being executed? How am I being listened to? Where am I feeling discomfort? Is that discomfort that is healthy or harmful? You know, in what ways is the top engaging or disengaging, connecting or not? Does that meet my needs or my desires in that moment or over time? You know, it's like I know that I need to change my oil, so I do that. But if you ask me to change my oil, I don't know how to change oil. I just know it's really important to keep my car functioning.
But you know it's important, and how to find a qualified person to do so.
I do. I have happened into, I think in large part because of the actions that I've taken, you know, the activism as well as the education, I'm privileged in a way to have some choice over the skill level of the people with whom I play. And typically, those would be very highly skilled people. But I'm also an edge player, so I need to have a reasonable level of confidence
that you're going to go home in one piece, right?
Or as close to one piece as possible, yeah.
One piece at least a week later, when everything's knitted back together and everything.
Well, sometimes it takes months, but yeah. I'm still creating something from 2012.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It was a good scene, I take it.
It was a catharsis, and it served its purpose, and it also, you know, opened a bunch of space that I've been exploring for sure.
And we, when we were setting up this interview, we were talking about consent, and your curve on that's a little different than than what is maybe the current politically correct party line, and I think we agree that the current party line may be a little too rigid.
Well, I think the pendulum has swung, and possibly necessarily so, and at a global level. And I say this also having worked with not only people who have been assaulted, but also counselors who work with people who have been assaulted. The necessity for clarity is great. It is very high. So the concept that yes means yes, you know, the NCSF consent counts, and enthusiastic consent, and caution against doing something that hasn't been prepared or pre-agreed to, yes. And my experience of consent is not black and white. It's very gray.
But you are also an experienced player.
I'm an experienced player, and I can say with a pretty high level of confidence that I'm an effective communicator. So I don't personally use safe words. I actually use sentences and will talk. And if I'm too much into headspace, then that becomes a barometer for my top or my dominant. Okay, she's not talking in complete sentences. We have reached a limit or a boundary. And, you know, that it doesn't mean that play stops, but it does mean that adding things, again, it's gray, right? So if I can't say yes or no, then clearly the answer is no.
So when you start to one word, it's time for them to start probing at the edges and finding out what is possible and what isn't.
Or just to have that be the limit for the moment, because there's always the next time, tomorrow, later in the evening. You know, my world experience isn't that everything starts and ends with a scene. That's a moment in time over time, even if it's the one time I'm going to be playing with that person. So how do I make it right and correct and consensual in that moment? And sometimes that looks like very involved dialogue before and going through, you know, like the Jay Wiseman list, what's in and out, you know, and that's a really effective tool. Other times, particularly if I have a larger context of knowing somebody, it could be as simple as don't put any marks on me.
So you have watched many new players come in to the community. From what I am thinking, I'm hearing, you suggest that they start slow and work on their communication skills.
I don't have a canned answer, but my general disposition towards new player, new person, new experience, new toy, like whatever the new is proceed with as much understanding and willingness to deal with the result as possible. So often that looks like staying in the shallow end. You know, like if I or somebody, just to use myself as an example, anytime I play with, I have a couple phobias, anytime I play with that, I know that there will be long tail results that will be longer or go past the moment of a scene. And I personally need to be in a headspace, a life space, a body space to be able to deal with the consequences of that. And if I'm not, I don't play with that fear.
So you think well beyond the immediate act of the scene.
Oh, yeah.
To the hours, days, and even weeks.
Yeah, it's a matter of responsibility. And that's a very core value of mine, that I take responsibility for my action. And not maybe the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of my actions, but at least one generation past. That I know that I have had that direct, I mean, it's thermodynamics, right? So, and if I'm not certain that I can be responsible, then I do less. It's just like weightlifting. I might want to bench press 175 pounds, but, and when I say I here, I mean you or anybody. But if you don't work up to that, to be able to lift that weight and push that away, then you're just going to have a world of hurt and possibly injuries. So you work up to it.
Possibly lasting injuries.
Yeah. Is it worth it? And if it's worth it, then great. But that have that be what it is and be fully in that and take responsibility.
Do you believe that we are communicating to bottoms this philosophy well enough across the community?
I can't speak to that.
I know you are communicating it.
I have such a limited point of view. I mean, an experience, you know. I would hope, my hope and dream is that consenting adults are not only capable of consent, but understand nuance and meaning beyond an action. But I think that's bigger than the context of the lifestyle. I think that's in the world. And we don't typically teach kids how to be and think and talk that way.
No, we don't.
Raven Caldera, I remember taking a class of his once, and he put forth the concept of teaching children safe words.
I think it's a brilliant idea.
Oh, but it's so radical. Teach the kids, don't say Johnny likes you, that's why he's hitting you. Say Johnny, she said to stop. That's where you teach, I think. that's where you start teaching consent.
Well, I have long thought that we need to extend the safe uses of safe words in our own lifestyle to all interactions.
Yep.
You and I, we like to play with the edge, and when you play at that edge, you're going to sometimes make mistakes.
Can we define edge?
Whatever edge you're talking about. Whether it be edge play or a flirtation or a aggressive flirtation. Let's say aggressive flirtation, because we have become very politically correct in that area. So aggressive flirtation can, if it's misplaced, can be considered very stalkish or even more violent acts. But for some, that aggressive flirtation is what they're looking for. And I think using the safe word in all interactions in our community may be a good starting point. If somebody's coming on to you in a way you don't want, just say red.
Well, and I was just thinking that's a great use for the stoplight metaphor. It can be a shared language where if red means stop, and I actually safe worded on my chiropractor last week. You know, the deep tissue is a little too deep. And all I could say was like, red, and he stopped.
But he got the message.
He totally got the message. And there's a moment where, had I gone into some big, long sentence about, hey, man, what you're doing right now is a little bit, it would have, for me, gone beyond that my ability to be in that moment. So just to have that one word to signal stop, very useful.
And in our lifestyle, if people hear that red surrounding you and the aggressor continues to be aggressive, we have clear mechanism to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know how clear the mechanism is, but it certainly increases the efficacy of the bystander effect, which is shown again and again to be critically important to people maintaining body sovereignty, particularly on college campuses with the, you know, high incidence of date rape and drunken sex and unwanted attention to all genders. If a safe word exists, if red exists in the world, it makes it easier for bystanders to impact the situation. And the bystander effect, it's real, and it can save so much pain and suffering.
On everybody's part.
I think so, yeah.
Maybe this podcast will lead some people to rethink their life and the way they do things. We are here to educate.
Maybe parents will be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If my brother and I had a safe word growing up, I wouldn't have sent him to the hospital half as much as he did. Just from the fighting.
That brings a very interesting idea. We are bringing up possibly our first true generation of children that are born to kink parents. We had them for a long time, but they have been very, very limited. And with the rapid expansion and the 50 Shades and explosion, I'm thinking we're going to have a different group of kids come up in the future.
Possibly. I mean, it certainly has been the case with polyamory and swinging, which I think has been more, not entirely visible, but less hidden.
Well, it's easier to make a reality show about polyamory than about BDSM.
Yeah. Although those poly people might be beating the shit out of each other behind the door. I mean, at a certain point, does it really matter how you express your love as long as it's in a way that's not harming the people involved? And to me, play and SM activity is an expression of love, but it's also nobody's business at the end of the day.
Other than those who you share that activity
exactly.
with.
Exactly, yeah.
So what's in the future for Bindi?
Oh, goodness me. I have ideas, but I'm not going to answer.
Oh.
I definitely will be teaching more, and I'm working on some literature, and I'm making some choices right now about how, with my activism. I just spent a few years in the decriminalization zone, specifically with cannabis, but in general, substance. And I want to say decriminalization, not legalization. Those are distinct.
Yes, we talked to Judy Goring from NCSF in a recent podcast about that, and decriminalization is a way to go. Legalization opens up to government intervention.
I think decriminalization opens it up to government, you know, intervention. If you look at how things have played out in Washington and Oregon,
well, true.
So I mean, as soon as commerce and trade is involved,
they find a way to regulate
it. Be in the black market. There's no way to do it without.
They find a way to regulate, don't they?
Yeah.
So we need to watch the Bendy channel to see what comes next?
I guess so, yeah.
Is it a channel or a network?
It's just BendyYogaGirl.com. And actually, it's a one-page site today. Hopefully, by the time this gets published, it'll be more than one page. But I would say most of my writing, almost all my writing, is available on FetLife. You know, teaching and working and being. And I have a whole big life that's even bigger than Bendy. So.
Yes, the real world. But all of it's real to you, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You know, I get accused often of using a scene name because of I'm hiding something or I don't want people to know who I am. And in fact, I'm very out and I choose to write and teach and produce under a different name. People can search for it. I wrote a open letter to Guy Baldwin after a Leather Leadership Conference. I want to say it was 2011. His keynote speech.
Herding cats.
I don't know if it was herding calves, but he made so many declarations in the speech about how, and I get that I have privilege because I'm heterosexual. I certainly have privilege because I'm white. But he was suggesting that people who use scene names are doing so out of some sense of shame. And we should stop hiding and don't be in shame and get up and be out like our forefathers, you know, because a lot of this happened specifically because of Gay Leatherman. We can't not say that. And I'm not sure, I definitely didn't agree with him then about shame being the reason. And I don't agree with him now, though the assumption almost always is that people use a scene name because of shame, that they don't want to be seen or visible in the world. And I think that's it's a limiting belief, it's a limiting perspective. And there are people in the lifestyle who have scene names and are out. I just don't want people to come to my house, you know, uninvited.
Well, some of us are in a position where careers could be very negatively impacted by
our families,
any association. And it's not that we are ashamed of our activities. We just are taking a healthy dose of caution.
Yeah. And I think that part of sovereignty has to necessarily be choice over how visible, you know, opacity and transparency and, you know, I'm not sure if I saw WonderCunt on the street, I'd be like, hey, WonderCunt. That would be inappropriate in any social context. But I'm certainly also not going to say her name in a kinky context without her consent if everywhere online she's WonderCunt.
And she's consistent in that identity she has created.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the difference in the is that she's consistent and you're consistently Bendy. I'm consistently LD Beast. And
and
those are our identities in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we're hiding. We just are being healthily cautious.
Yeah. And some people are hiding. And why make them wrong? I mean, so much of the story that we have, the rhetoric around BDSM is about choice. You know, it's about sovereignty over the body, over the actions of the body, over relationship structures, over so much. And I think if a person chooses, then that's their choice. It's not my business.
It is theirs to make. And we're supposed to be looking for individuals to and supporting individual rights and to make their own decisions. It's what I see that we're supposed to be doing.
I would agree.
Well, Bendy, thank you for spending this time with us.
You're welcome.
Listeners, there'll be links on our hot page for to get to Bendy's websites. and go and check her out.
Thank you. Be kind about it, people.
And look for her in your area as an educator.
Yeah.
And thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. This was great. I enjoyed it.
You have been listening to episode 88 of The Kinky Cast. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our Kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week when we have Desmond Ravenstone of Lever and Grace.